Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 30th of October, these are our main stories. British MPs have voted to hold a general election on the 12th of December. After weeks of protest in Lebanon, Prime Minister Saad Hariri has announced he will step down. A senior White House official has said he personally heard Donald Trump ask Ukraine to investigate his political rival Joe Biden. Also in this podcast, Boeing's chief executive has testified before the US Senate, where lawmakers took him to task over a pair of fatal plane crashes.
These loved ones lost lives because of an accident that was the result of a pattern of deliberate concealment.
And Kurdish fighters have passed the deadline to evacuate northern Syria as the Turkish military ends its ceasefire. We now know that 2019, one of the most tumultuous years in British political history, will end with a snap general election.
The ayes to the right, 438. The noes to the left, 20. So the ayes have it. The ayes have it. Unlock. Order.
After three failed attempts, Boris Johnson has finally convinced the House of Commons to support an early poll on the 12th of December. Here's Mr. Johnson making his case for the election.
To allow us to make our case, and above all, to allow a new and revitalised Parliament with a new mandate to deliver on the will of the people and get Brexit done.
The main opposition Labour Party had repeatedly blocked Mr Johnson's push for a national poll, arguing a no-deal Brexit needed to be stopped at all costs. But when the European Union agreed to a January the 31st extension, the party's leader, Jeremy Corbyn, changed his mind.
To defeat this government, to bring in a government that will end injustice, poverty and inequality in this country. That is what I joined the Labour Party for all those years ago, and that I'll be very proud to take as our message to the people of this country.
I asked our correspondent outside the Palace of Westminster, Rob Watson, whether this election will be a de facto second referendum on Brexit.
I think it's hard not to see it that way in part. I mean, Brexit is the extremely large elephant in a very small room. And I think certainly the Conservative Party, governing Conservative Party, wanted to be about Brexit. It wanted to be for them getting Leave voters to come out and say, yep, let's vote Conservatives to get Brexit done. Then, of course, you have the out-and-out anti-Brexit parties, so the Scottish National Party, the Liberal Democrats and the Greens. And they're also very happy for this to be a Brexit election, with their clear message that we are anti-Brexit and this is the last chance to stop it. But I think, interestingly, that the main opposition party, the Labour Party, doesn't really want it to be about that. It wants it to be more on sort of socio-economic lines, more about poverty and more about austerity. And it seems to me that the result of the election will be determined by to what extent do the Conservatives scoop up all the Leave voters, to what extent is the Remain vote divided, and to what extent can Labour actually make this about something other than Brexit.
Boris Johnson has been desperate for an election for some time. Why did the Labour Party in the end decide to support it?
It's a very good question. I mean, the first rule of politics is what does your opponent want you to do? Do the opposite. And we know that Mr Johnson wanted an election. I mean, I think in the end, the Labour Party didn't really have much choice because the two other opposition parties, the Scottish National Party, the Liberal Democrats, they had taken the view they weren't going to get a second referendum in this Parliament. Therefore, their best chance of stopping Brexit was to have a general election. And once they had done that, and I think once the European Union had granted an extension to the Brexit process, there wasn't really much that Labour and Jeremy Corbyn could do to resist it, despite their looking at the opinion polls and thinking, my goodness, we could be in trouble here.
How big a factor is the opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn in this upcoming vote?
Well, obviously the next few weeks and the final result will determine that, Alex. But look, it's no state secret that his approval ratings are absolutely down, and that most voters see Boris Johnson as a better prospect as Prime Minister than they do Jeremy Corbyn. I would add one thing in, though, and that is if you look at the opinion polls, both Mr. Corbyn and Mr. Johnson have very much negative approval ratings. In other words, more voters dislike them than like them.
Rob Watson. After 2 weeks of protests across Lebanon, the Prime Minister, Saad Hariri, has announced he will step down and take his cabinet with him. These people in Beirut saw the move as an important development for the country.
The resignation of Hariri is a first step in building a patriotic, democratic country. The first achievement of the 17th of October uprising has been realized. Now we have to start planning for the second achievement and look forward to it.
It was expected under the pressure of this people's uprising. It was something joyful for the Lebanese people because he was one of the symbols of the authority and the authority's strength. They really should all be held accountable, and no way should he come back as Prime Minister.
Our Middle East editor Jeremy Bowen filed this report on Mr. Hariri's resignation.
The demonstrations have paralysed parts of Beirut and other Lebanese cities, and now they've brought down the Prime Minister, Saad al-Hariri. They started almost 2 weeks ago over proposals for new taxes. Since then, they've grown into a mass movement, mostly of the young, against unemployment, economic collapse, and leaders who they see as beneficiaries of a corrupt political system. Mr. Hariri went on live TV to announce his decision. He said he was on his way to see the Lebanese president to tender his resignation because, he said, so many Lebanese had taken to the streets to demand change.
For 13 days, the Lebanese people have waited for a decision, for a political solution that stops the deterioration of the economy. And I have tried, during this period, to find a way out, to listen to the voice of the people. It's time for us to have a big shock, to face the crisis. I'm going to the presidential palace to present my resignation. To all our partners in political life, our responsibility today is how we protect Lebanon and revive its economy.
Mr. Hariri will stay on as caretaker until a replacement can be found. The most powerful force in Lebanon is Hezbollah, the pro-Iranian militia and political movement. It benefits from the status quo before the demonstrations, and it sent men to central Beirut to beat protesters who are trying to change it. That is a worrying sign given Lebanon's violent history. The events in Beirut are part of a new wave of protests across the Arab Middle East. Hundreds of anti-government demonstrators have been shot dead in Iraq. In Egypt, security forces crushed protests against the police state. Discontent is increasing across the region, and a series of inadequate, inept, or illegitimate governments are struggling to deal with it.
Jeremy Bowen. A leading White House official has said he personally saw Donald Trump put political pressure on Ukraine's president in a bid to obtain information on his political rival, Joe Biden. The revelation is being hailed by some of Mr. Trump's opponents as a landmark moment in the ongoing impeachment investigation. Our North America editor John Sopel reports from Washington.
With each day that passes, the impeachment inquiry becomes more serious for the president, and today it took another dramatic turn. Until now, those around Donald Trump have sought to dismiss the whistleblower's complaints as hearsay, based on no direct knowledge of what unfolded in the telephone conversation between the US president and his Ukrainian counterpart, and in particular, whether Mr. Trump tried to muscle Volodymyr Zelensky into investigating his Democratic Party rival Joe Biden and his son Hunter. But now the Intelligence Committee is hearing from someone with first-hand knowledge. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, a decorated war veteran, was listening in to the July the 25th call as a director of the National Security Council. He's also the first person still working at the White House to give evidence, and he flatly contradicts the president's assertion that the call was perfect. In his written statement, Lieutenant Colonel Vindman said, "I did not think it was proper to demand that a foreign government investigate a US citizen, and I was worried about the implications for the US government's support for Ukraine." He says it would undermine national security and result in Ukraine becoming a partisan issue. He also gives evidence that this White House's attempts to have the Bidens investigated long predated the phone call. The president has dismissed Lieutenant Colonel Vindman as a never-Trumper. But this is a career diplomat and serving army officer who's worked with successive administrations, whether Republican or Democratic.
John Sopel in Washington. Last year, 346 people were killed in two crashes involving the Boeing 737 MAX plane. The entire fleet of planes has been grounded since the second accident. And now the boss of Boeing, Dallas Muhlenberg, has admitted his firm did make mistakes. Our transport correspondent Tom Burridge reports.
This hearing will come to order.
After two crashes of the same type of aircraft in the space of 5 months, Boeing's boss Dennis Muhlenberg today in Congress faced a barrage of bipartisan anger. A new automated flight control system, which malfunctioned before both crashes and put each plane repeatedly into a nosedive, was not in the flight manual. Pilots had, Senator Richard Blumenthal suggested, been misled. He said Boeing had, in effect, designed a flying coffin.
These loved ones lost lives because of an accident that was not only preventable, but was the result of a pattern of deliberate concealment.
Senators also accused Boeing of failing to disclose text messages between two of its employees, which appear to raise concerns about the 737 MAX. The company's CEO, Dennis Muhlenberg, did admit it was wrong that design features linked to safety were optional for airlines at an additional cost. One senator described it as safety à la carte. For the families of the 157 people killed in the second crash in Ethiopia, one key question is why the plane was not grounded after the first crash. Mr. Muhlenberg had this answer.
We have asked that question over and over. And if we knew everything back then that we know now, we would have made a different decision.
Dennis Muhlenberg rejected the notion that Boeing's relationship with its US regulator was too cozy, but admitted his company had maybe been policing too much of its own work. Boeing has redesigned the 737 MAX to make it safer, but Senator John Tester said he'd rather walk than fly on the aircraft.
Tom Burridge. Also coming up in this podcast, anti-racism advocates have said Bulgaria's national football team deserves stiffer punishment after fans unleashed yet another torrent of racial abuse.
Ultimately, we're not taking the issue seriously and massively disappointed, but, you know, truly, honestly, it's probably what we expected.
And a Nepali mountaineer has broken the record for climbing the world's highest peaks. Tuesday evening marked the deadline for Kurdish fighters to pull back from part of northern Syria as a six-day ceasefire agreed to by Turkish forces drew to a close. The Russian government, which brokered the deal, has been monitoring the withdrawal. The BBC's Middle East correspondent Tom Bateman is on the Turkish side of the border with Syria. He described the scene to my colleague Tim Franks.
Well, as the clock ticked past that 6 p.m. local time deadline, we had a statement from the Russian Defense Minister, Sergei Shoigu, who said that the Russians were satisfied that there had been a complete withdrawal of Kurdish forces from that crucial 30-kilometer zone running south of the Turkey-Syria border, deep inside Syria. Critically, that was the area where Turkey President Erdogan had said that YPG Kurdish fighters must withdraw. That was the aim, he said, of their incursion that began 3 weeks ago. Turkey regards those Kurdish YPG fighters as a terrorist organization. He said if they didn't get out by the end of the 150-hour deadline that was put together in this deal with Russia, that he would, in his words, crush them. So the deadline passed. We had that from the Russians. Turkey then said that it would carry out joint Russian-Turkish patrols to monitor that Kurdish forces have indeed left.
Have we heard anything from the Kurdish forces themselves?
Well, throughout this and over the last 48 hours or so, There have been statements from the leadership of the YPG saying that they would honour the commitments in the Turkey-Russian deal. Although the Turks had said as recently as Monday that they regarded there not to be a full withdrawal, they said there were still 2,000 fighters around the town of Manbij. We've heard none of that kind of talk since the deadline passed.
You talked about this plan for there to be Turkish-Russian joint patrols. This is also territory that Kurdish forces ran in a sort of in a political sense as well over recent years. Do we know what the longer-term plan is?
Well, some of those border towns, as you allude to, are absolutely crucial to the Kurds there, to the YPG, but also to the broader political project for Kurdish autonomy. They controlled from those towns a huge swathe of eastern Syria, east of the river Euphrates, so they were really key towns. So in terms of the control of the area, remember just a few short weeks ago, you had these Kurdish forces on the border with Turkey, the two sides' bitter enemies, in terms of the YPG group at least, watched over by American forces. The two had been in a key alliance against IS militants, Islamic State militants. And what you have now, after President Trump's decision to remove American forces from the area, is really a decisive shift in the power of balance in Damascus's favour, because you now have that border area carved up between President Assad and by Turkey, all carrying out now joint patrols along a stretch of that border, and Syrian forces also present President Assad back on that northeastern border.
Tom Bateman in Turkey. You'll remember earlier this month we were talking about a football game between England and Bulgaria that was overshadowed by racist abuse directed at England's black players. England won the game 6-0, but the abuse was all people were talking about. Now, European football's governing body, UEFA, has announced how Bulgaria will be punished, and for many, the punishment is not enough. Charlotte Gallagher has this report.
But the referee has clearly brought things to a halt here. We had fears of incidences of racist abuse.
Nazi salutes, racial abuse and monkey noises, all on display at Bulgaria and England's Euro 2020 qualifier. And it wasn't the first time. Part of the stadium was closed because of previous racist behaviour by Bulgarian fans. Earlier today, UEFA delivered its judgment. Bulgaria will have to pay $83,000 in fines and play two home games in empty stadiums, though one of those games has been suspended for a period of 2 years. UEFA could have gone further and thrown Bulgaria out of the competition. Troy Townend is from the campaign group Kick It Out. He says the punishment isn't tough enough.
We didn't expect much, you know, from a stadium that was partially closed anyway. It's now a full closure. It's now a suspended sentence. And the money is the money. Some say for a federation like Bulgaria, that's quite a lot of money. Ultimately, we're not taking the issue seriously and massively disappointed. But, you know, truly, honestly, it's probably what we expected.
The England under-21 striker, Rian Brewster, said UEFA's decision was embarrassing, writing on Twitter, the world needs to wake up to the problem. Racist abuse in football isn't just an issue in Bulgaria. Players across the world have suffered from it, and for many, the sport's governing bodies aren't doing enough to stop it.
Charlotte Gallagher. For some of us, the mere sight of a snake can induce fear, panic, or even irrational behaviour. That's what appears to have happened to one man in eastern China who cut off his own finger after being bitten by a snake. I asked our Asia Pacific editor, Celia Hatton, what on earth he was thinking.
So a 60-year-old man was working on a mountainside in China's Zhejiang province when he was bitten by a snake. And he was horrified, he said, because that particular snake is known locally as the five-step snake. That's because it's expected that after it bites you, it's so venomous, it's so deadly, that you will only walk for five paces before you drop down dead.
And because of that, he decided to cut his finger off.
Absolutely. He was so terrified, he chopped off his own index finger because he thought that would take the venom away from his body. He said he thought it would save his own life. He then traveled to a hospital, which was about 80 kilometers away, And when he got there, the doctors were then horrified because they said, look, that kind of snake is not as deadly as you think. You had about 6 hours to get medical treatment. And what's more, if you'd kept that finger that you cut off, we could have reattached it. And so now this man is now at home with a heavily bandaged hand, and he's recovering, albeit without an index finger.
So it's known as the five-step snake. Does this mean that this is perhaps not the first time this has happened?
Yeah, doctors say this happens quite often in this part of China where patients come, about 1,200 patients a year with bites from this kind of snake. And doctors say that around a third of those people have done something really dangerous to themselves in order to protect themselves from what they think is a deadly bite. So some have burned their skin to try to burn away the bite. Some have wrapped their limb or their finger so tightly in wire or rope that the limb or the finger is actually getting gangrene by the time the person seeks medical treatment. So doctors in this part of China and really across China are saying, look, think about how deadly this kind of snake is before you try to treat yourself.
Celia Hatton. A Nepali mountaineer and former British Gurkha soldier has climbed the world's tallest 14 mountains in less than 7 months, smashing the world record. 36-year-old Nirmal Purja is celebrating reaching the top of his 14th peak. The BBC's Richard Hamilton reports.
Trying to find the rope, yeah? Snow's too deep, right, brother? Yeah. This week we're trying to find the old ropes.
This is Nirmal Purja in April scaling Annapurna, the first of his 14 mountain challenges. 189 days later, he climbed to the top of his last peak, Shishapangma. All of them are above 8,000 metres. The previous record was held by a South Korean climber, Kim Chang-ho, but it took him nearly 8 years. Purja's climbing career began when he walked to Everest Base Camp in 2012, and instead of returning as planned, he decided to climb the entire mountain. In August, he told the BBC's Colin Murray that he climbed Everest, Lhotse and Makalu in 5 days, but it could have been three had he not stopped for 2 nights to have a drink.
We summited Everest, we were the first team to summit so, and immediately after that, our main team summited, which made the total of, I think, 13 Gurkha soldiers mm-hmm. on the summit of Everest. But what I did after that was I came back to Kathmandu and we had obviously partied for a week. Then I went back again.
You say we obviously partied for a week?
Yeah.
I love that. We obviously partied for a solid week, no sleep. Moving on, continue your story.
So I went back to Everest base camp and I climbed Everest. Then I climbed Lhotse, then I climbed Makalu. So that's the world first, fourth and the fifth highest mountain. And nobody has climbed that in a season. A season is normally a year. And I did that in 5 days, stopping for 2 nights for a drink at Namche. Otherwise, I could have done that in 3 days.
At Everest, he took a photograph showing hundreds of climbers on the summit ridge. The picture, which went viral, led the Nepali government to draft a new set of climbing rules aimed at reducing the crowds on the world's highest mountain.
Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.